art, culture, politics, activism. Now, art in the pandemic age. Have you ever wondered why artists do what they do? What is their purpose? What are they trying to accomplish? I'm your host, Kyle Roman. Welcome to Artivism Now. Artivism, defined, is a portmanteau word combining art and activism. How is it that artists push the boundary of their medium? How do they move societies forward? How do they resolve issues in their neighborhoods, both local and worldwide? These questions are what we set out to answer by interviewing artists locally and the world over. We will get answers to those questions that artists put out there in the community.
All right. Welcome to Ana Maria Alvarez here, all the way from South LA. Thank you for joining us on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right. And how would you describe yourself as an artist in terms of like your medium and the work that you put out?
Yeah, so I definitely would describe myself as a movement artivist, that I am also a mother, a daughter, a sister, you know, a leader. I would definitely describe the work that I do as body-based, both movement and text. I work a lot with, I have a dance company and we are a dance theater company, but the work is very much about, you know, the human form and the human being and our movement and how it's connected to the movement, a larger framework of movement. So that's why I love the word movement, because it traverses both, you know, the work I do with the body, but also the work that I do with politics.
Yeah, it has that double meaning. And that's, you can find Ana Maria on Instagram at Movement Artivist. And you were talking about your dance company. You are the artistic director, founding and artistic director for Contratiempo. Can you maybe give us a little rundown of what Contratiempo is all about?
Yeah, so we just turned 15 years this year, actually.
Oh, congrats.
So we were going to have a quinceañera, but COVID hit. So that put that on hold. We might have a sweet 16 next year.
There you go. Yeah, you got to have that.
the company was really founded out of my graduate thesis work at UCLA, where I went to go get a master's in choreography and was really interested in how choreography and performing the body could be an act of social, you know, resistance and could create social change. At the time, it was also really about trying to figure out how I could create art that I was able to fully encompass my wholeness. You know, I was born the child of two labor union organizers, and so I was from the very beginning very clear that whatever I was going to do needed to make a difference in the world. And it's funny because my sibling Cesar Alvarez and I both turned out to be artists. So Cesar is a composer, incredible sound designer, but also writes these wild musicals, multi-genre musicals.
Amazing.
And is now teaching at Dartmouth. I don't know if you hear my stomping upstairs, but those are my kids.
That's quite all right. That's the beginning of them joining the dance company, right?
Yes, exactly. It sounds like rhinoceri.
No, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. It's a family friendly show.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, being the child of, and inside of that just activist household, and also growing up in the picket lines, you know, playing inside of union halls or creating our first shows in, like, you know, these very deeply rooted community spaces where we were, our family was not just our blood family, but very much our chosen family, our family, what we call our village. They raised us, and So I always knew that that was going to be, you know, whatever I wound up doing was going to make a difference in that way. With that said, I always loved dance. Since I was 5 years old, I just have always wanted to be moving my body and turning on music and creating shows, you know, super elaborate. My poor parents were so, you know, such a good sport, such a good sports. Yeah. I was constantly organizing all of the neighborhood children and all the children of our village, any kind of, you know, get together, there would always be a very large elaborate show that I was directing and creating performing in. And so, you know, just that. And then I also started studying dance as like every time we would move all the time because of my parents' work, the nature of my parents' work, we were constantly on the move. But everywhere we went, I would, my mother would always find that community center dance class or like spaces where I could be moving and dancing and taking class. So I did do more kind of like the traditional ballet, tap and jazz all the way up until high school. And then realized I really was, I just really wanted to find something that I felt fully myself and discovered Dunham. Catherine Dunham's work, and also began studying Afro-Cuban and Afro-Haitian, West African. Salsa also was like a through line through everything. So all of these dance forms were kind of, again, none of these forms in this were always done in the same space or same time, but I was traversing all these different worlds. And you know, when I became college age, really realizing that the academy was very, very ballet and modern based, and dancers were a lot of times like taught to be quiet and move, you know, like there wasn't a sense of have a strong political voice or a strong political agenda in your work that really, and that also sort of this, I mean, I got told things like, what if you stopped using your face so much or leaning in on the storytelling aspects of what I was really interested in, a lot of times weren't encouraged in the field, in academia. So I wound up going, I'm giving you kind of like a long, you know.
No, this is fine.
How I got to go to the Ensemble, but I wound up actually right out of college. I went to Oberlin College, which Oberlin is like a small liberal arts college in Ohio. Yeah. Known for its leftist agenda, for sure. It's radical training, you know, it's training of young activists. And so that was really a wonderful place to kind of have this little incubator of me really developing a strong artistic and political voice. I was a politics and dance major. And I wound up taking my junior year in Argentina and studying tango and like traveling, hitchhiking all up and down the country, you know, meeting with so many different people and learning all about just South America and colonization and also like the politics of Argentina at that time. And it was right before everything happened, you know, everything kind of blew up in Argentina. So that was, you know, again, all these kind of experiences coming together and building. I became a tango dancer. I was also a salsera. Also love, a deep love for Afro-Cuban, Afro-Haitian, Dunham technique. And then I actually, when I was 19, I think I was 19, I went to the Urban Bush Women Summer Institute. And they, I don't know how familiar you are with the Urban Bush Women.
No,
they're
I haven't.
Incredible dance company whose work has been around for 30 years, led by Jawale Walla. Jawale is both a choreographer, but definitely a change maker. She was really a mentor to like help me discover and open up that, oh, I could be a choreographer and I could be a movement artist. You know, I could be somebody who is actually really making a difference in the world. So I could be a choreographer and I could be a radical activist and I could be a change maker and I could be a dancer. And I could, you know, like these things weren't separate from one another, but they were actually deeply feeding one another if I opened myself up to that. So that was the moment where I was like, okay, this is possible. Moved to New York, danced there professionally for about 4 years. Was in a bunch of different people's companies. You know, I did some work called Lesbiango Tango with this woman, Susana Cook, where I was doing all this gender bending stuff with tango. I was really
fascinating
into the Afro-Haitian scene, dancing with Julio Jean, who's a choreographer, a Haitian choreographer in New York, you know, doing, again, being a dancer more than anything. Yeah. And then also my day job, which was deeply filling my well, was working with a social service agency called the Center for Family Life, Lifelines Community Arts Project. And I was basically, it was a full-time job of choreographing with seventh and eighth graders who were in a really, you know, a pretty rough neighborhood in Brooklyn. Their realities were pretty, their lives were pretty tumultuous, and bringing their lives into creative work as a way of healing and as a way of empowering them and as a way of developing their strong youth leadership and voices. So it was really, you know, working deeply with social group workers inside of artistic practice. And that just, I mean, that work with Julie Brockway was the leader of that organization. And that just changed my life also. It really gave me an incredible tool set of social group work to use inside of the creative practice and use inside of the choreographic practice. So I was like, okay, so this is, feeling how this is all possible, but still in the field, when I would go to rehearsals and when I would go into all these, you know, creative spaces, I was like either the Afro-Cuban dancer or the Afro-Haitian dancer. I was a modern dancer. I was a salsera. I was a theater person. Like, it was never, I was never able to like be my full complexity of who I was until I started making my own work. And so I decided to go to graduate school at UCLA and get my master's in choreography for the purpose of building work where I like truly could exist in between all these spaces. And really started figuring out that my work was really about the in-between, which is the contratiempo, right? The contratiempo is in between the beats. And then also the idea of contratiempo being against time, right? Like pushing against times was a very, I love that kind of wordplay. As my mother is white, a white American, my father is Cuban, born, raised in Cuba, grew up in the revolution, wind up, coming over right after the revolution. His family was originally supportive of the revolution, but wound up feeling betrayed by the revolution. So there was like that whole, his upbringing was very conflictual around all of that. And then he wound up becoming a union organizer. So that the way that I grew up to and the family that I came from was always about the in-between. It was never about a duality making sense, or it was always about like the spaces in between that where everything felt like it was possible. So that's why I really wound up kind of exploring and delving deeper into. And then I created a thesis concert called Contratiempo that upon graduating, we wound up performing it with the cast of 12, which is I was crazy. 12. Now we're going to be seven. but 12 people, we went, we toured to New York and we wound up doing all these shows. And I had a bunch of mentor meetings with artists that I really deeply believed in and loved their work. And they were like, you already have a company. Like, you just need to file for something. Like, we would never tell anyone to make a company because it's so hard, but you're already doing it. So you might as well. Official. So I kind of, I never had the like set out intention, like I'm going to make a company. Or I'm going to found a company, but I really felt very quickly the need for the kind of work that I was interested in creating, and that if I didn't create that work, then I actually didn't belong anywhere. So there was a really deep sense of belonging, of like creating a space to belong and to advocate for the kind of work that I was doing in our field as both mattering and as being legitimate was really a deep impetus for starting Contratiempo. Now 15 years later, I'm so happy to say there's so many incredible artists making this kind of work. And that inspires me and makes me feel so much hope for our future as a field. There's still a long way to go, but I've stood on so many incredible shoulders to be even where I am, but I can see the future is, it's bright. There's a lot of recognition and acknowledgement for some of the people whose shoulders I've stood on, and they're starting to become more people working in the vein of both connecting politics to movement and art making, but also the bringing together of all these different, you know, both genres and styles and ways of being and cultures. And it's just, it's encouraging to see yeah. more of that happening now. So, I mean, that was a very like, you know.
No, that's great. that's great. Nobody wants to hear me talk anyways, so. No, that was perfect. That was a great summary of, I think what people need to know is how connected your life experiences are to the work that you still do every single day, and how one has fed the other. It's fascinating that your graduate thesis, your master's thesis, became this thing that still exists.
Yeah.
15 years later, I can't even imagine my graduate thesis. Like, I was just like, get it done. This is nothing. This is gonna become nothing. I am just like, this is it. It's done.
I'm making a piece, it needs to be good enough that we can put it out there in the world. it's interesting.
And here you are, right?
Yeah.
And here you are, well, 15 years later, and it's
absolutely. It's a
full-on dance company that has all the elements of all the things that have made you who you are over the years.
Well, I will say the piece Contratiempo too, and I think this is just something that I hold as a deep value in art making, is that I think when you're coming at the work that you do from a place of like both urgency and necessity, like it's like I wasn't making this piece because I was like, oh, I think I should make a piece about this, right? The Contratiempo, the work. The actual piece Contratiempo, which I also played with Against the Times, is Against the Times / Contratiempo. It was a piece that grew out of the Bush era of, you know, there was all of this anti-immigration legislation that he was passing, and he was constantly in this conversation of like, if you're resisting the stuff that I'm saying and doing, then you are anti-American. It was being really, you know, I mean, God, looking back at that, that seems like peanuts compared to where we are.
It does.
Like, why were we even complaining about?
I was just thinking that.
There was some pretty outrageous stuff that he was doing and saying.
There was just
this rhetoric of, if you're pushing back and you're resisting, that is anti-American. And I was like, I was immediately like jumped on this idea of no, resistance is actually American. Like
is American, yeah.
If there was anything that our country is seeped in and is resistance, right? And so to say that I'm being anti-American by resisting is absolutely completely, you know, counter to what is the truth. Now, I'm not saying the resistance was always in a good, you know, good or bad. I'm not quantifying or qualifying it as but the idea of resistance itself. And in salsa, you need that resistance. Like when you dance salsa, I don't know, have you ever danced salsa?
I'm half Puerto Rican, so yeah.
Okay, so you know a little bit about the resistance. When you're with a partner, if you don't have that resistance, if you don't have that push and pull, you literally are like floppy noodles.
Yeah,
you know,
there has to be that kind of that pressure, you know, that two-way
you need
pressure.
That pressure. Yeah. Exactly. And so I was really interested in that metaphor for our society of like how that resistance is so critical to who we are as a people, but also is critical to like our histories and our futures. And so the piece really was about resistance in that way and pushing back against these things that I didn't believe in. But I also, I think originally resistance was like fight resistance, right? And I think as I've grown more mature as an artist, really realizing that resistance is also about love, and resistance is about connection, and resistance is about compassion and like a deep belief in each other's humanity and like all of those parts that I think but I say that because I think that's why the piece turned into something, because it was about what was happening in the world. It was about something that was really it wasn't about just creating a piece. It was actually, we were building a movement, right?
Yeah. That time was, and that's kind of the era that, you know, bore me into an activist, radicalized me in a sense. You know, I guess maybe put the cherry on top of the radicalization. I, like yourself, we had talked, have, you know, union backgrounds on our, yeah, on our families, and so it was always there. But you're right, as a young adult in that time, it was all born out of the anti-Muslim nature of 9/11, and then mm-hmm. all of a sudden, and it turned into anything. If you questioned any of the leaders at the time, then you were thought of as that anti-American type person. Yeah. It was conflated with anti-Americanism, when in reality, like you said, it's the exact opposite. If there's one thing,
to be complacent
is anti-American. And so I think that's it's a way to describe how a lot of people were radicalized, I think, at the time. And I think that that the fact that we still have your work coming out of that is fascinating, because you know, we had the whole the Occupy movement kind of in between then and now. Mm-hmm. So there was that kind of upwards radicalization happening as well. And then now, right, the now is where you're seeing some accelerated forms of radicalization from multiple, you know, issues that are presented in our society. And so that kind of brings us to the election. That's a couple days away here. You know, you personally are a politically active citizen. And so this election, from someone who is working, you know, directly with community members in South LA. And so, you know, you have a lot of contact with the community. What is it that you're hearing? What's driving people to the polls for this election?
Yeah, it's funny because Los Angeles, I mean, I'm definitely connecting with folks locally, but I feel like a lot of what I've done for this election has to do more with both in Florida, because that's where
reaching outwards, yeah.
But also, you know, I've been doing a little bit of phone banking in Arizona as well. You know, an hour here, an hour there, when I'm able. You know, I know that people are being barraged with calls from all over the place, but this is how we're text messages and calls. But this is how how we're organizing, you know, amidst COVID.
Absolutely.
I think, you know, both art making art making is about reframing narratives, and also finding, for me, it was really about finding power and where my power is, like, where are the places that I know that what I'm doing and who I am can make a difference. And that difference is shifting narratives. That difference is, you know, having a really clear and articulate critique and giving ideas of what, you know, futures that are different than the future, than the present that we live in can be. So imagining a future is really, I feel like, the work of an artist. With that said, there are in that idea of looking for power, I think, you know, voting is something that is directly connected to power. I mean, we in our country are hiring and firing the people that are running our country, you know, I was talking to an activist who works with Black voters in North Carolina the other day on our Place at the Table conversation. We have a weekly conversation with Mama Artivists or other activists. And she was saying, like, you know, people who don't vote are literally not participating in the job that they have to hire and fire the leaders of our country. Like we got to think of ourselves as these entrepreneurs who are, it's our job to make sure the people who are running things are doing what they need to do. And if they aren't, we need to let them go, you know, and that your voting is actually participating in that. And I also think about how many of our ancestors have not been able to vote, right? Or to not be able to participate in the system and in this specific system in this way, either by citizenship or by the color of their skin or by gender or by, I mean, how many people were not even given the privilege or the, you know, again, we call it a privilege because it wasn't a right always, right. But it should be a right, has always should have been a right. Mm-hmm. And so even if that's the only reason you vote is that there's so many,
because you're
right. able to. So I've always, you know, thought of even if I'm not super opinionated about what's happening, which I am very opinionated usually, but even if I'm not, still like that casting that vote is a critical part of, you know, actualizing that power. And so, yeah. You know, I think in the Hillary Trump election, a lot of people didn't wind up voting because yeah. of that very, because they were like, I'm not, you know, super excited about, and I've heard people say that about Biden and Trump as well, but the bottom line is like, you got to take a stand. You need to take a stand. You need to take an, yeah. because if you don't, the people who are not necessarily people that you agree with will. And so yeah. I think it's really, that's just a critical piece. But also the voting in your local elections, I think people think yeah. about the presidency as this, like the main one, but you know, there's so many incredibly yeah. important decisions to your own individual life that are happening locally. And so, you know, I mean, I love California because of all of our propositions, and you know, that voting yeah. here is like, takes days of research and figuring things out and what you're gonna stand by and why you're gonna stand by that, and like seeing who the people that you believe in are voting for, advocating yeah. for, like, you know, it's a whole process. But I think it's since moving to California almost 19 years ago, that I think that's been something I've actually loved about being in this state, because I feel yeah. like I've become more interested in the local politics in a way, right. because there are so many things that are changing yearly through the people who are elected on a local level. So I can't advocate for it enough. And with that said, I think we're in a really crazy time right now. You know, it's a wild time right now in terms of, you know, is the election really going to be both respected? Yeah. We've already had the 45 has already said he's not going to concede. So like, what is that going to look like? You know, we have white supremacists coming out of the woodworks, you know, crawling out from under their rocks, being empowered to show up in public spaces. I was just driving down the street from here the other day and saw a huge Trump rally of people that I don't think are from Los Angeles. They seem very much from outside of the city. They were not, they yeah. did not look like Los Angelinos. And, you know, I think that we're going to start seeing that happening around. I mean, I know people who are complete in total gun, you know, opponents, and who have bought arms because they're worried about what's going to happen. So I think we're in a really, volatile moment in time right now. And so if there was ever a time to participate in the system and shifting the system, it's right now. And this is one way of doing it. With that said, again, it's not ending after voting, because none of the people who are even, you know, are on the ballot right now are gonna by themselves without pressure and pushing and
right.
huge amounts of advocacy and pressure gonna make the decisions that are really in the interest of everyone. So I think mm-hmm. we got to keep the pedal to the metal, you know, after the election. The election's yeah. the first step, and then after that, it's really gonna be a continuing to press for climate. You know, for both yeah. climate, for racial justice, for economic justice, for education, you know, socialized education. I'm all about, like, college should be free for folks. So like, you should right. be able to get a college education for not, you know, going into 20 years of debt. I mean, there's so many things that we need to be putting the pressure on about, that this is the beginning. You know, voting is one of the steps, one of the many.
It really is the backbone of yeah. what is supposed to be a democracy, right? And so the fact that there is so much evidence out there already in other states of voter suppression and Republican Party officials, you know, working the courts to mm-hmm. challenge large groups of voters. And then also here in California, in multiple places, there were the false drop boxes that were discovered directly linked to the Republican Party. And so, mm-hmm. You know, what's normally thought of as, at least before the 2000 election, it was thought of as this kind of sacred act that is mm-hmm. purely apolitical and, you know, more about, you know, a more of a bureaucracy than any sort of partisan thing, is now almost completely corrupted by partisan yeah. politics.
Yeah.
Are you hearing any sort of voter apathy through yeah. Through your work?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I've heard people say that they don't feel like it matters, or at this point, you know, like I haven't, even those folks I feel like are kind of starting to move over.
Right.
Or to start
they're like, we really don't have a choice this time.
You know? Exactly.
You really don't.
But I have heard people say that it doesn't matter, you know, that Biden and Trump are the same. And that's absurd. I mean, that they're just not. Like, there are things that I think, you know, Biden is not somebody who I voted for in the primary, and is not somebody who I like would have chosen as my number one candidate. And Trump is, you know, a fascist Nazi. Like, I'm just sorry.
Yeah.
It's like, you can't compare the two of them. He's literally calling, he is a white supremacist. I mean, you look at the history
yeah.
of, you know, of even what he was doing in New York around discrimination, housing discrimination.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many examples of his white supremacist tendencies. You mm-hmm. just can't, you can't compare the two in a way, like they're not comparable. And so I just, you know, that piece is, I also, you know, to Latinos, there's so many white Latinos voting for Trump.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but the white supremacists don't see you as Mm-mm. white. Like, you might be white passing, but,
right.
but you are not Aryan race. And like, that is not, they're coming
yeah.
for all of us. So that is
yeah.
the bottom line. And I mean, I've had that conversation with a bunch of, you know, light-skinned Latino voters who are like
yeah.
seeing Trump as a possibility, or as the candidate that represents, you know, the things that they believe in. And it's just, it's absurd. And so I just, it's absurd, but it's also, there's, I think, an illusion of the proximity to whiteness that has you be incredibly blind. And so,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I think some of my family has forgotten that they're immigrants and refugees, and
right.
that connection to our own humanity, and seeing
yeah.
like the lack of empathy that is such a part of this person's, you know, both history and also entire
yeah.
campaign platform. You know, I just think we need to move more into empathy and connection, and, you know, seeing one another as each other, you know, like that Ubuntu, I am because you are, that value is
yeah.
so needed right now in our society and in our system, because it wasn't set up for that.
Right.
But I believe we can reframe and move more towards that. I really do believe that.
Well, of course you do, because it's literally the work you do, right?
Yes.
But you find those spaces in between and make those connections. When you're speaking about that, it definitely does give me hope, because and I think it would a lot of other people too, because it illuminates how actually close we are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I feel like sometimes people think that we're in such a desperate position, which we are. However, we're in a desperate position because the reality that we thought we knew
mm-hmm.
is coming crashing down. But the mm-hmm. the newer reality of becoming more community, you know, engaged in your community, and you know, going back to loving thy neighbor, and
mm-hmm.
you know, the simple lessons like that, I think are right around the corner, because you see it, and even in my bedroom suburban community that I live in now, you know, people are like wrapping around one another, helping each other get through tough times, you know, the way it used to be. And the way we were growing was more atomized and more separate. And that's how the corporate influences and power structure want us to be, is more separate.
Feel separate. Well, there's also something that I think there's been an opportunity around this pandemic and the social distancing and the isolation and the quarantining that has, I mean, I described it to you before we started recording, you know, there that as a touring dance company, we've always been deeply rooted in our local community, but we also spent a lot of our time on the road and traveling across the country and sometimes internationally as well, and doing this work and connecting it back to Los Angeles, but very much traveling and connecting lots of people. Yeah. And this pandemic has had us root down back in Los Angeles. And we've actually just recently, literally this week, got several grants to do programming here in Los Angeles. And it's allowing us to again, just root back down from where we came from and where we are currently. And that work is so critical and important, but in the world that we lived in, we were just moving a million miles a minute and not having that actual space to root down. And so I think that there is something that's really beautiful that's happening, like you said, with local communities rooting down and taking care of one another in a different way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, there's an opportunity to not just once this is passed, flip back to where it was, but how are we going to continue to learn from that, to learn actually the value and that it's critical to actually take space and time to root down and to build that, to build those deep community connections. So I'm excited actually about this future, even though it's going to look very different than how it looked in the past. And you know, I described to you by being a parent 24/7, my own work is looking very different than it has in the past. Yeah. And everything that I'm doing has to involve my kids being a part of it until school is back in session, which I don't think is happening anytime soon in LA.
Right.
It's an opportunity. I don't remember that saying. Is it a Chinese character that is also is challenge and opportunity are the same character? Am I getting that right? Have you heard this?
I have not heard that, but that sounds sounds profound.
Yeah, that it's that challenge and opportunity are the same thing, right? That it really is. They're so deeply in relationship with one another.
Yeah. And listening to that really makes me wish I was in LA so I could get involved with you guys personally.
Where are you?
I'm up north in the East Bay Area, in San Francisco Bay Area. So
I was like, the Bay has so many amazing things happening. I wish I was up there with y'all.
Yes, no, totally. There's always that Bay versus LA, you know, quasi envy. I wish I was down there. I wish I was up there.
I'll say, I think I always joke with my Bay Area family and loves. We've always had a lot of Bay Area folks in the company.
Yeah.
But we've always joked that Contratiempo is a Bay Area company in Los Angeles. our politics are more Bay than LA. But.
You know, it really does remind me of, you know, some of the work that I've seen out in Berkeley and Oakland and San Francisco. I think maybe that was why my eye was drawn to your guys' work through Instagram and the website and everything. And so let's get that out there again. Let's Movement Artivist on Instagram. Contratiempo is contra_tiempo on Instagram. And then the website is contra-tiempo.org to check out their work. And founder, director, Ana Maria Alvarez, thank you for joining us today. It's been an amazing conversation, and we didn't get too down in the dumps about the election because there's a lot of hope and positivity that we're seeing for people.
it's important to, like, again, always be framing it. I mean, we talk so much in our organization about radical joy, right? That joy is a practice, it's a muscle.
It is.
And that inside of a lot of hopelessness or a lot of times where there's a lot to feel paralyzed by, that we got to be working that joy muscle, because it's a practice. It's a, and it gives us it's futuring, right? It's giving us the future. So I'm always very grateful for spaces like this to share, you know, just a little bit more of the details of our story and where we come from. Yeah. And so thank you for the work that you're doing too. I appreciate it. And I'm excited to know about you now and to listen to more of the podcasts.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for that.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate everything.
All right. I appreciate you coming on the program, and maybe we'll check back with you again soon after the election.
Absolutely. Take care, Kyle.
All right. Have a great rest of your day.
Ciao.
Special thanks to Ana Maria Alvarez for joining us today on this episode of Artivism Now. You can find her at contra_tiempo on Instagram and Movement Artivist on Instagram. And remember, artists out there, keep it lit, let it flow, let it mean something, and goodbye.